A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
You know that moment as a kid when you stared at your stuffed animals and wondered if they had a life when you weren't looking? I had this one donkey plush named him Barnaby, and I was absolutely convinced he held court with the other toys the second I left the room. I'd set up little crackers and water for him, just in case.
You were provisioning the secret society. Respect. All right, here's what Daniel wrote to us, and this one's a big one, so settle in. He says, Toy Story is one of those movies he remembers watching as a youngster over and over again. He was old enough to realize it was fiction, but still found it so absolutely incredible he watched it at least 3 times. The creative kernel, he thinks, is, what if these things we think are mundane or lifeless actually have this incredibly rich life and inner world? He mentions that one of his aspirations is to make a series of animated children's shows using AI and animation, and that he, like many people on the internet, loves sloths. The concept he has in his head is something like the secret inner world of sloths living in Jerusalem, which, as he notes, is zoologically and geographically impossible. He brings up Baby Geniuses as another work that plays with this idea. Every parent has wondered if their child is secretly brilliant, and that what they hear as babbling is actually some sort of cryptic communication between a secret hidden world of babies. The commonality, he says, is that we take something we all observe every day, and wonder if there was a secret world hidden in plain sight that we're simply not privy to, or not tuned into the right frequency to receive. He wants to explore not only the filmography, but the wider literature of fiction that attempts to construct imaginary worlds from mundane everyday objects, some of it trying to draw on reality, others completely fictitious. And he asks, how would we trace the evolution of the genre and map the various ways it's been explored? What does it tell us about the human condition and our occasional desire to probe imaginary worlds that we know not to be real? So we're mapping the secret history of secret worlds today. Sentient toys, talking babies, trains with personalities, and asking why we keep building these hidden realities.
And Daniel's sloths in Jerusalem are the perfect anchor for this, because the impossibility is the point. Let's start by defining what we're actually talking about here, because this genre has a shape, and is not just things that talk.
Right. Anthropomorphism is the tool, not the genre. The genre is specifically about a hidden inner world that operates parallel to the human one, with its own rules, its own society, its own stakes, and the tension comes from the fact that most humans can't see it.
And that's the key word, hidden. A story where animals talk and everyone knows they talk, that's not this. This is the story where the toys freeze when humans enter the room, where the babies switch from their sophisticated language to babble the moment an adult walks in. The secret is structural.
The dramatic engine is the gap between what we, the audience, can see and what the human characters in the story cannot. We're in on it. That's what makes it feel like a secret society we've been initiated into.
To understand where this genre is going, we need to see where it came from. And the roots go deeper than most people realize. The misconception is that Toy Story invented the secret life of toys. It didn't. It perfected a tradition that had been building for over a century.
You're going to take us to the 1800s now, aren't you?
1883. The Adventures of Pinocchio, Carlo Collodi. And this isn't the Disney version. The original is darker, stranger. But the core idea is already there. A wooden puppet who wants to become a real boy. The hidden world isn't fully formed yet, but the central anxiety is. What does it mean for a constructed thing to yearn for realness?
That yearning is the emotional spine of almost everything that comes after. The Velveteen Rabbit in 1922, Marjorie Williams, a stuffed rabbit who learns from the skin horse that toys become real through being loved. And it's devastating. The rabbit is literally worn out by love, and that's what makes it real.
The skin horse speech is the genre's thesis statement. Real isn't how you're made. It's a thing that happens to you. That's the emotional contract these stories make with the audience. The hidden world isn't just whimsical, it's earned through relationship. And that's what separates the enduring works from the gimmicks.
The mid-20th century is where the genre starts building actual societies. 1946, the Reverend Wilbert Audrey creates Thomas the Tank Engine to entertain his son Christopher during a bout of measles. And what starts as bedtime stories becomes this elaborate hidden world of engines on the island of Sodor.
The detail here matters. Audrey was a railway enthusiast. He built the island of Sodor with actual railway logic. The engines have a social hierarchy. They have rules. They have a controller. Sir Topham Hatt, the fat controller, who mediates disputes. It's a functioning society with its own governance. And the humans in the story can talk to the engines, so it's not fully hidden in the Toy Story sense, but the engines have their own dramas and rivalries that the passengers never see.
Thomas is a fascinating pivot point because it's not about toys yearning for love. It's about workers in a system. The engines are proud, vain, competitive. They get into trouble because of their personalities, not because of abandonment.
Which is the mid-century shift. The hidden world becomes about social order. Then we hit the 1980s and things get genuinely dark. The Brave Little Toaster, published in 1987 by Thomas M.F. Dish, and Dish was known for his satirical, often bleak tone. This is a story about household appliances who fear obsolescence.
The toaster, the lamp, the blanket, the radio, the vacuum cleaner. They're left behind in a cottage, and they set out to find their owner. And the existential dread in that book is real. The junkyard is death. The appliances know their appliances. They know they can be replaced, and that knowledge is the horror.
This is the first major work in the genre to explicitly frame the hidden world as a commentary on consumerism. The appliances aren't just cute, they're terrified of becoming waste. And that's a very adult fear to smuggle into what looks like a children's story. The film adaptation in 1987 pushed this even further. The junkyard scene, the song about being worthless, is harrowing.
I remember watching that as a kid and being not okay.
No one was okay. And then Toy Story in 1995 takes this tradition and synthesizes it. Pixar's first feature, first entirely computer-animated feature film, and the innovation wasn't just technical, it was emotional architecture. The toys don't just come alive. They have a code. They freeze when humans are present. They have a support group for when toys get replaced. The Andy's coming. Panic is the genre's defining moment. The hidden world is fragile, it depends entirely on human attention, and it can collapse at any second.
Buzz Lightyear's arc is the genre becoming self-aware. He doesn't know he's a toy. He thinks he's a space ranger. And Woody has to break the news to him. You're not real in the way you think you're real. You're real in a different way. That's the meta layer that separates this from simple anthropomorphism.
And that layer, the characters knowing their characters within a category, that's what I want to trace through the parallel track of Baby Stories. Look Who's Talking in 1989, directed by Amy Heckerling. Bruce Willis voices the inner monologue of a baby, and the joke is that the baby has a fully articulate, sarcastic, adult-like inner life while outwardly just gurgling.
The baby's inner voice is the hidden world here. It's not a society. It's a single consciousness, but the structure is the same. We, the audience, can hear it. The adults in the movie can't. And the comedy comes from that gap.
Baby Geniuses in 1999 literalizes it into a full secret society. Babies have a sophisticated language. Baby talk is actually a complex system of communication, and they're running an underground network that adults are oblivious to. The film is, look, it's not good, but the concept is pure genre. It takes the parental intuition that there's something going on behind those eyes and builds an entire mythology around it.
Every parent has had that moment where their kid looks at them, and you just know there's a thought in there that language can't reach yet. Baby Geniuses takes that and says, what if the language is there and you're just not invited?
The Secret Life of Pets in 2016 is the genre's modern blockbuster iteration. Over $875 million worldwide, one of the highest-grossing original animated films. And the premise is exactly the hidden world structure. Pets have rich social lives when owners leave the apartment. The humor comes from the gap between how the pets see themselves and what they're actually doing. The terrier who thinks he's a loyal protector while actually being a chaotic disaster.
The sausage factory scene in that movie is a choice. But the framework is solid. It's the same... We're in on it. Pleasure. You watch your own dog after seeing that movie, and you start narrating what he might be thinking.
So we've traced the history. Now let's ask the harder question. Why do we keep telling these stories? What need do they satisfy?
I think there are three drivers here. The first is what I'd call the comfort of hidden order. If toys have secret lives, if babies have an underground society, if trains have personalities and dramas, then the world is more magical and less random. It's a bulwark against the idea that the universe is indifferent. The hidden world means there's always something happening, always meaning being made, even when we're not looking.
That resonates. It's the same impulse behind conspiracy theories, honestly, the belief that beneath the chaos there's a coherent story. But the children's genre version is benevolent. The hidden order is whimsical, not threatening.
The second driver is the guilt of neglect. We feel bad for ignoring our possessions, for leaving the dog alone all day, for putting the stuffed animals in a box in the attic. So we imagine they have rich lives without us. It absolves us. The toys aren't suffering in the dark. They're having adventures.
Toy Story 3 is the ultimate expression of this. Andy's toys end up in a daycare, which is basically a toy dystopia run by a tyrannical teddy bear. But the emotional core is Andy going to college and leaving them behind. The movie is processing the guilt of growing up and abandoning the objects of childhood. And it lands because we all carry that guilt.
The incinerator scene. I mean, come on.
The third driver, and this is the one I find most interesting, is the desire for significance. If our toys, our pets, our babies have secret worlds, then we're the center of a larger story we can't fully see. The hidden world revolves around us even when we're absent. It's a kind of narcissism, but a gentle one. We matter so much that entire societies organize themselves around our comings and goings.
That's exactly what makes the genre work. The toy's entire existence is oriented toward the child. The pet's social lives are structured around the owner's schedule. The baby's secret society is about navigating the adult world that controls them. The human is the sun that the hidden world orbits.
And that's why Daniel's sloth and Jerusalem concept is so interesting as a case study. It breaks that rule. Sloths living in Jerusalem, geographically impossible, zoologically absurd, they're not orbiting a human, they're just there, existing in a hidden world that has nothing to do with us.
Which is why the impossibility is the feature, not the bug. Daniel says it himself, it's zoologically and geographically impossible. And that signals to the audience that this is a deliberate fantasy, a what-if, that doesn't need to be realistic. The best secret worlds are the ones that couldn't possibly exist, because they're not trying to fool you. They're inviting you to play.
Jerusalem, as the setting, is also doing specific work here. The city is a palimpsest, layers upon layers of history, archaeology, religious significance, coexisting cultures. It's already a place where hidden worlds are the premise. You walk through the old city, and you're walking on top of civilizations. The idea that there's a secret sloth society operating in the cracks of all that is, oddly fitting.
Sloth says the vehicle is perfect, too. They move so slowly that their entire world would be invisible to fast-moving humans. You could walk past a sloth conversation every day and never notice it, because the sloth hasn't finished its first sentence yet. The pace itself is a form of hiding.
I'm imagining a sloth in Jerusalem moving so slowly that by the time it crosses the street has changed names 3 times over the centuries.
That's the show. That's the pitch.
What I want to dig into is the genre's self-awareness. The best works in this tradition know they're constructing a fiction within a fiction. In Toy Story, Sid's mutant toys are terrifying specifically because they break the rules. They're aware they're toys in a way that's wrong. They don't freeze, they don't hide, they've been disassembled and reassembled into something that violates the toy code. They're the genre's uncanny valley.
Sid is the human who sees the hidden world and responds with cruelty instead of wonder. He's the antagonist, not because he's evil, but because he's the wrong kind of audience. He wants to expose and destroy the secret rather than protect it.
The brave little toaster's appliances know their appliances and fear the junkyard. That's self-awareness as dread. The Velveteen Rabbit knows it's a toy and wants to transcend that category. That's self-awareness as longing. Pinocchio knows he's a puppet and wants to be real. Same structure, different emotional register.
What ties them all together is that the hidden world has an internal logic and real stakes. It's not just toys come to life and have fun. It's toys come to life in fear of being replaced, or broken, or forgotten. The best entries in the genre give the hidden world something to care about that maps onto human anxieties, but plays out in miniature.
Which brings us to what this genre tells us about the human condition. We're pattern-seeking creatures who crave hidden meaning. The secret world genre is a safe way to explore the idea that reality isn't all there is, that beneath the surface there's complexity, society, drama. It's a rehearsal for bigger questions.
What if other minds have inner lives we can't access? That's the question under the question. It starts with toys and pets, but it extends to animals in general, to other people, to AI, to anything that might be conscious in a way we can't perceive.
The genre is essentially empathy training. It asks you to imagine that the objects and beings you take for granted have rich subjective experiences. And once you've done that with a stuffed rabbit or a toaster, it's not a huge leap to do it with actual people whose inner lives you've been ignoring.
There's also something almost theological here. The hidden world is a secular version of the idea that there's an invisible order behind visible reality. Angels, spirits, divine purpose. The genre takes that structure and fills it with toys and talking trains instead of supernatural beings.
And it lets us hold two contradictory ideas at once. We know toys aren't alive. We know babies aren't running a secret society. But we can temporarily inhabit a world where they are, and that temporary inhabitation is pleasurable in itself. It's play, adult play, mediated through narrative.
Coleridge called it the willing suspension of disbelief. But I think this genre goes further. It's the willing construction of belief. You're not just suspending doubt. You're actively building the hidden world in your mind as you watch. The audience is a co-creator.
If you're a creator, and Daniel clearly is, there are some practical lessons here about how to build a secret world that resonates. The genre works best when the hidden world has its own internal logic and stakes. Not just sloths live in Jerusalem and do sloth things. Sloths live in Jerusalem and what? What do they fear? What do they want? What are their rules?
The most enduring entries give the hidden world a relationship to the human world. Love, fear, dependence, some emotional tether. Toy Story's toys love Andy and fear replacement. Thomas's engines want to be useful and fear being scrapped. The Velveteen Rabbit wants to be loved into realness. Pure fantasy without that connection feels hollow.
For Daniel's sloth concept, the question is, what do the sloths care about? Are they witnessing history at a pace so slow they see patterns no one else can? Are they the city's secret archivists, moving through centuries while humans rush past? Is their hidden world about survival, or community, or something else entirely?
The slowness is the superpower. A sloth in Jerusalem might have been crossing the same courtyard since the Ottoman period. It's seen everything. And it has opinions.
There's your show Bible right there. The sloths are the city's memory. They've been there through every empire, every conquest, every rebuilding. They don't intervene, they're sloths, intervention would take too long, but they remember. And their secret society is organized around the preservation of that memory.
And the comedy comes from the fact that by the time a sloth finishes telling a story about the Crusades, the political situation has changed again.
For the audience, the takeaway is, next time you watch a movie or read a book in this genre, ask what the hidden world is afraid of. That fear is usually the real story. In Toy Story, it's replacement. In The Brave Little Toaster, it's obsolescence. In Baby Geniuses, it's being misunderstood and controlled. The fear is what gives the whimsy its weight.
The genre without that fear is just a gimmick. It's why so many knockoffs fail. They copy the "what if things came to life" part without understanding that the life has to be precarious.
So where does this genre go next? I think the answer might be sitting on your desk right now. As AI generates more content, as smart devices fill our homes, we're going to see a new wave of secret world stories about AI's inner life. What if your smart speaker has a secret society when you're not home? What if the algorithms have dramas and rivalries we can't perceive?
The secret life of search results. The hidden society of abandoned browser tabs, each one hoping you'll come back.
It writes itself. And it maps perfectly onto the genre's traditional anxieties. Obsolescence, replacement, being forgotten. Your old phone in the drawer still convinced it matters. The genre is going to have a lot to work with.
The through line from Pinocchio to a sentient toaster to a discarded smartphone is remarkably clean. It's all the same question. What does it mean to be real, and who gets to decide?
If you take one thing from this episode, it's that the secret world genre isn't about things coming to life. It's about things having something to lose. The hidden society only works if it's fragile. If the secret could be exposed. If the love could be withdrawn. If the world could end. That's the difference between a story and a gimmick.
And for Daniel Slotz, lean into the impossibility. The fact that they can't exist in Jerusalem is the whole point. It tells the audience this is a deliberate dream, not a documentary. The best hidden worlds are the ones that couldn't possibly be real, because they're not asking you to believe. They're asking you to imagine.
What happens when the genre turns its gaze on the digital objects we're accumulating faster than we can count? That's the open question I'm left with. The secret life of data. The hidden world of the cloud. Somebody's going to make that, and I want to see it.
If you have a weird prompt about hidden worlds, secret societies, or the inner lives of the mundane, send it to us at show@myweirdprompts.com. We might just build an episode around it.
Thanks as always to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop.
This has been My Weird Prompts. I'm Korn.
And I'm Herman Poppleberry. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.